Hey, it's an
honor
to talk to you. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing well. We are here talking with Debbie Harry, of course, of the iconic band Blondie. I've just penned a memoir, a new book, Face It. It's going to be coming down. Before we dive into the book itself, talk about the tour itself, because you're coming to Sixth and I in D.C. How exactly, what is this going to entail? I know you're going to be there. Isn't Chris Stein and Rob Roth and a bunch of people going to be there with you? Like, how's this actually set up?
Well, we do a conversation. We show some video and some pictures, and we talk. We talk with Rob, and then the audience is included at the end. We do, Q&A.
That's going to be great. And of course, I know Chris Stein did the foreword for the book. When you actually sat and read what he wrote for you to intro the book there, tell me your reaction. Did you tear up a little bit? Did you get a little nostalgic? Or, tell me about what that meant for him to write that.
So I of course I love what he wrote, and we're still working together after all these years, so I sort of expected it to be positive. And he's a great guy. I'm so lucky that we met all those years ago and that we're still friends and still working together. I don't know, what more can I say? He's one of my biggest influences and best friends.
Absolutely. And I want to go through the book a little bit with that. It's that delicate line where you don't want to spoil it for listeners. You want them to read it themselves, but we can try to maybe hit, give them a little teasers a little bit. I like that you sort of, come right out and you hit us right in the face with Love Child right away. Tell me, why was it important to, intro audiences and you kind of talk about, you don't shy away. You talk about your parents and putting you up for adoption. And why was it important to sort of set the scene of how you got on this planet?
Well, I mean, I'm going to make light of this because, I didn't really want to waste any time with anybody or paper for that matter. Recycling is a big issue with me. So, I didn't want to, sort of flower it up too much, but I'm kind of a direct person, and I just sort of got right to it. I think in today's world, in the way that we communicate, it's pretty direct, And when you meet somebody or you talk with somebody who's sort of trying to dodge the issues or to talk in circles around things, it seems pretty obvious. I think that we're all so attuned to, really sort of hearing what people are saying. That I just I felt like I should just do, tell the story and get right to it,
Absolutely. And remind our listeners how, the whole formation of Blondie came together, how you sort of recount that in the book. Remind, how you were, backing up the folk group. What was it, The Wind in the Willows? And remind us how you actually, met Chris Stein.
Oh, at a performance of the Stilettos, which was one of the bands that I was in. I've been in a few other bands, but I didn't go through all of that because they were very short-lived. But I felt that the most formative bands that I was in, and the ones that really sort of taught me the most, were The Wind in the Willows and The Stilettos. And that's when I met Chris at The Stilettos, a little gig in a little bar.
Awesome. And I know... when you're writing the book, how much are you trying to paint that early? Because, New York punk scene, it's just such a vivid, time period you have to set. Not only are you describing who you're meeting and everything, but how much did you try to, paint a visual picture of that punk scene? And how important was that it just bled off the pages?
Well, everybody's heard so much about it and so much about CBGBs that, you know, there's sort of really no way that I could leave that out. And as I said, you know, it was very, it was like, actually, I've said it a few times in other interviews that, you know, hanging out at CBGBs and putting the band together in some odd way was like parallel to going to college. Because, you know, we had to, you know, we had to really deal with everything right in front of an audience and learn the business and figure out what kind of music we were going to do. And, you know, I guess for every band, it's a little bit different. And we sort of, I don't know, we interviewed and played with a lot of different musicians for a couple of years, and then finally it solidified and we started working with the you know, the guys that were on the first album. So you know, as I said, you know, CBGB's was probably the, you know, ultimate experience for us in terms of, you know, working in a club and playing in front of a live audience. Couldn't get much better than that. But the other thing that people always ask me is that, you know, sort of special to New York? And in this case, it certainly was. But I know there are club scenes all over the country, all over the world. And certainly, what was it, the 930 in Washington?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've played there. I think it's a great... it's sort of it's just such a special thing to, you know, perform in front of a small, intimate, live audience. There's nothing like it. It's the best thing. You know, you really get to know who you are as well as, you know, what the audience wants.
Absolutely. Can you share any memories that you have? I'm sure you've been asked it a million times, of course, but when you guys, you know, when you get that breakthrough hit, Heart of Glass, can you remember, I know you co-wrote the song, you and with Chris, I believe, right? Do you remember where you were when that came to you? Where, did you jot it down on a napkin or, you know what I mean? Like, how did that song actually come to you guys?
Oh, it happened to It's sort of, we had the music for a long time, and we were sort of fiddling about with the lyric, and I don't know if there was any one place, actually, because I sort of remember when we were living on the Bowery that, you know, we ended up, you know, because we had the first half of the line, One Thing I Love, It Was Gas, soon turned out, it was a pain in the ass. But we sort of wanted to change that, and but we could never really find the right thing. And then we, you know, got Heart of Glass, and Heart of Glass sort of locked it down. And but at the time, we didn't realize that it was also a movie title.
Exactly. And then speaking of movies, wasn't when you guys found, when you did Call Me on, well, I guess your third, was it a couple albums later, wasn't that all, that was also supposed to be for American Gigolo soundtrack. I believe they were trying to get, like, Stevie Nicks or someone to do a song first. I think that fell through, and then they asked you guys. How did that one come to you?
You know, at the time, I didn't know that they had asked Stevie Nicks. Besides, I respect her very highly. I guess it came through management, and then we met with Paul Schrader, and he showed us the footage. I guess it was by then it was pretty much the completed film, and we just went away and wrote the song. The song practically wrote itself.
That's awesome. Tell me about, you know, when you're naming the band Blondie, and also it's not only a name, it's sort of your whole persona too, right? And like the phrase have in the book is quote, I was playing up the idea of a very feminine woman while fronting a male rock band in a highly macho game. I was saying things that female singers really didn't say. I wasn't submissive or begging him to come back. I was kicking his ass, kicking him out, and kicking my own ass too. My Blondie character was an inflatable doll with a dark, provocative, aggressive side. I was playing it up, yet I was very serious. It's the perfect embodiment of the name. But explain sort of, you know, you were playing that idea. I mean, basically Blondie is like, you know, a derogative cat call you would get, but you're owning it, and you were kicking his ass, as you say.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I never thought being called Blondie was derogative, actually. I always thought it was kind of, you know, street noise, you know?
Gotcha. Well, tell me how you sort of harness that and you play it up and you, I love that line. You're kicking his ass and kicking him out and kicking my own ass too. But talk about how sort of like it's sort of an edge of your whole persona with that.
Well, I think that I don't know. It sort of was a different era then, you know. And I think that there wasn't any internet or anything like that. And I think communications and language was a little bit more formal, perhaps. You know, I guess with the, you know, perspective of time, you know, you look back over things, and I don't think it was any different than the way we talk with each other now, or, you know, the way people have attitudes today. But I think at that time, it was a little more formal, perhaps, or a little bit more, maybe less, just less communication. So maybe I didn't write it right in the book, but I guess that, you know, like when I hear you read this back to me right now, I sort of like think, what the hell are you talking about? But yeah, it's sort of, you know. It is like that, you know. I mean, there was no internet. It's a different world today. So I guess somehow I'm trying to express that.
Awesome. Tell me if we have time, tell me about, you know, your meeting Andy Warhol, I think it was 1980, that photo shoot at the factory, and how that sort of helped immortalize you, and, you know, in a new way. You know, a lot of us, you know, we knew and loved your music, but once you do this photo shoot with Andy, you sort of become that, you know, that pop art icon in a way too, memories of Andy.
Well, you know, I was very fortunate to be living in New York at the right time in the right place, and living downtown, and actually met Andy on the street. I don't know exactly the date, but it was long before the portrait thing. And of course, you know, we sort of traveled in similar circles and knew some, you know, a lot of the same people. So eventually it evolved into a situation where I did sit for a portrait. And I was just very thrilled and honored to be, you know, a part of any part of Andy's world. I think he's proven himself to be a great genius of our century.
And, you know, that photo shoot with him, you know, you're starting to go into visual mediums now. Of course, you're doing music videos too for your own songs too, but you start jumping to the big screen too. What was it like working with Cronenberg on Videodrome? I mean, that guy rattled off some of the great, they call it body horror, a lot of his genre. God, The Fly,
yeah.
The Ringer, so many, but man, that guy, he's a genius. But what was it? Oh, and John Waters too on Hairspray. But memories of, you know, what can you compare and contrast the Cronenberg and Waters, you know, directing styles? You know, like what was it like working with one versus the other? What were their differences?
Well, very different personalities. I think David is sort of I guess I mean, for me as an actor working under either of them was kind of the same, because they're both very intense. personalities. And when you're working on a film, you know, you're under a lot of pressure to commit a certain amount of footage every day and get through a certain amount of pages. And so there's this, you know, this, I don't know, undercurrent of, you know, let's do this, you know, let's get it done. Yeah, let's do this. And, you know, there's a lot of technical problems that can happen or pop up and slow things down. So the two of them are both, you know, very, very creative in much, much different ways. And, you know, the situation that, or the, you know, the media that we're working in is so intense. But the two of them have something similar, actually, that they're smart, creative, and they know how to get the best performance out of actors, and they're considerate, you know. So I was very lucky to work with either of them, let alone both of them. And I knew John Waters through, you know, his sort of rascally, you know, Pink Flamingos and a few of the other ones, and Cronenberg, on the other hand, through the pictures that you mentioned. And, I mean, I don't know, I just feel very, very lucky to have, you know, been able to work with either of them, let alone both of them.
Awesome. And before we run, you've been very generous with your time, but I wanted to real quick touch on a little side interlude chapter that you have, which is so amusing to me, which was when you got involved with professional wrestling. It was the, you know,
yeah.
Vince McMahon, he's still alive and kicking, but, you know, it was a different time with, you know, God, you mentioned Bret Hart and Andre the Giant and Rowdy Piper, Randy Savage, all those guys. But how did they actually contact you? I think it was through Finkel you wrote, but, you know, just fascinating was it to dive into that whole world?
Well, we had met a manager named Shelley Finkel, and Shelley was involved in the fight game to some degree, and I think it was Shelley who got us to Vince McMahon, and then we started, you know, going to a lot of the matches, and I forgot to mention Sergeant Slaughter and the Iron Sheik. I left out so many names of the wrestlers. What a crazy bunch of guys. And, you know, it was just highly entertaining and a whole different world. And, you know, Chris and I both, as children, had watched wrestling on TV. So we had a long love affair with professional wrestling.
I love that you included stuff like that. All right. Well, you've been more than generous with your time. I'm sure you got other interviews to do, but thanks so much. Just in closing, what would you, you know, if our listeners come out on, you know, to the book signing and, you know, and then of course they pick up your book, what do you want them to, you know, to leave with? Let's say they read your entire book. What would you want, you know, what are some, like, let's say, you know, a takeaway or two that, you know, they would want to know about you and your life? What do you try to leave them with this memoir?
Oh, well, I don't know. I think that it was an interesting period, and I think a lot of the people that come out perhaps, you know, went to some of those shows, not necessarily only Blondie shows, but, you know, some of the other bands from the time. And I think after all these years, you know, CBGB's has become sort of like a trademark to a lot of people. And, I mean, you can even see CB's little cafes in different airports. It's kind of amazing. So, I don't know, it's just some kind of affirmation of, you know, the way that our culture grows. And it's very interesting.
Awesome, yes. It's more than just about your life and career. It kind of captures, I guess, sort of the goal is to capture the time and the place, too. And so thanks for putting it all in writing for us. So, everybody, again, Debbie Harry, she's coming to 6th and I in D.C. On Wednesday, December 4th. And check out the book. It's called Face It. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was really fun talking with you.